This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicide, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. And joining me again, it's nice to say, when I get to say it, joining me again is an exceptionally talented writer. And I want to talk to you about two quotes that they've recently written in their work. And the first one, before we dive into this, the 157th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat, is in one of her many publications that she contributes to. She contributed to Senses of Cinema, SBS Movies, Kill Your Darlings, The Age, The Big Issue, but particularly one that I think is most pertinent to this movie and this cityscape is a terrific piece on Karen Kusama's Destroyer, starring Nicole Kidman. And my guest today said of Destroyer that it isn't interested in providing any comfortable solutions to spiny problems, which I love. And finally, that Nicole Kidman's Aaron's rage is a toxic substance and she saves the largest dose for herself, which is just gorgeous. Finally, she also wrote, which is her pinned tweet at the moment, cinema is a thirst machine, which if you compare those two things, you will see why I love this lady dearly and why I was desperate to have her back on the show and why she was such an important voice for me to get on in the thick of the sort of, you know, the pièce de résistance of this movie. Not the heist, but the conversation in the coffee shop. It's Joanna DiMattia. Joanna, welcome back to One Heat Minute.
Hi, Blake. Oh, my God, what a welcome. And I guess that does kind of sum up my very disparate interests.
Because when I read your pinned tweet, I loved it so much. I didn't see it at the time, and I hadn't seen it in a little bit. But when I saw that, it just encapsulated it for me, and sorry to take a tangent so early. There's these think pieces about like, oh, what do you thirst watch? I'm like, everything. Yeah, movies are thirst watching. Like, watch a Hitchcock movie. Like, just like, it's so frustrating. Anyway, so I just, some conversations you really like feel like Clint Eastwood saying, get off my lawn. Like, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. And that tweet just really, that really got me right in the funny bone. So thank you so much. But we're back, you know, we've gone from one scene that's thick with dialogue, loaded with themes, to this kind of mess of images, no dialogue, but chaos, emotions, textures, feelings, impulses, and it's a thrill that we're about to start talking about it together.
Yeah, I'm excited. There's so much in this 60 seconds. I was going to say 60 minutes.
That's a different show. If it was 60 minutes, we would be like just under three episodes. It'd be two and a bit episodes in this show's parlance. But no, 60 seconds, 157th minute. Again, just as a quick reminder for folks, if this is your first episode, thank you so much for listening and welcome. We're looking at the original theatrical cut of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat. And that means that if you've got currently what's available around the place, the director's definitive edition, you might be a few seconds out because it's actually from the Warner Brothers Blu-ray and DVD copy is where we've sourced it. So on our clock now, it's 2 hours, 36 minutes. So we're in the last 10 minutes of this film. It's kind of insane, just not to put it mildly. So what Joanna and I are going to do right now is we're going to watch this minute together and then we're going to come back and unpack it for you.
Go!
Oh, it's so good.
It is so good.
That is, I just love, you know, there's certain character traits. There's two things that really jump out at me, John. I'm not sure about you, but there's certain characters that, you know, people have associated with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, so Vincent Hanna and Neil McCauley in Michael Mann's body of work. Like some people say, oh, well, you know, Neil McCauley is like the is kind of evolved from James Caan from Thief. And yep. As an example, Vincent Hanna is kind of like Will Graham, so William Peterson's character from Manhunter. Like these are the guys who he's been kind of essaying and he tweaks them and adjusts them based on, I guess, the, I don't know, like the tone that he's trying to set for the different piece. And yeah, yeah. And so this is, you know, I sort of prescribe to, but also don't, because I think Mann's a little bit more organic than just like, I'm going to copy paste these two characters and see where they go in my head. But it's a little bit more evolved than that. But in this scene particularly, I just love Pacino's hands. They're like a pianist's hands. They're like waiting like for the energy, like the charge as he's going through this crowd. He's like trying to sense what's wrong. And there's just something so great about this. Doesn't have to say a single word. Beautiful economy of storytelling visually. What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? Boom. And then he catches this absolutely, you know, statuesque perfection of Amy Brenneman's face that's just there, perfectly lit. And then we get to see that warmth in her face, and even though her eyes are very cold, and we get to see her reacting, and then just the expressions of these guys bouncing off each other, the energy in this scene is just electric. I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about Pacino. I mean, I probably went on about this last time we spoke about, you know, the great physicality of him as an actor. But, yeah, he is. He's, like, moving through there and kind of feeling – it's like he's feeling his way through. And I do I love the way that that scene sort of begins I mean, you know, we're at the precipice of the climax, for want of a better expression. The moment he puts his feet on the ground of the airport, and but then, you know, I like the way we kind of lose him in the crowd. You know, there's the chaos of everybody else running around, and then he emerges, and you know, he's got this that determination and that focus, and it's really picking up on that whole conversation from earlier in the film that he had with Justine, and you know, when she said, you know, you're like a hunter following his prey. And you know, obviously he's been doing that obviously throughout the entire film, but I feel like this, you know, this minute, all of that kind of coalesces, like, and I want to talk about this a bit more later, but for me it's sort of there's a lot of, despite the complete absence of dialogue, I feel like there is a coming together of a lot of threads of ideas and the philosophies that both of those two men are kind of built on are all sort of coming into play at this point. And that's what's so exciting about getting to talk about it. I mean, I'd like to be able to talk about the 3 or 4 minutes after it as well.
Unfortunately, they're full up, but I would have you back if they weren't. But, but yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I've talked about this in roundabout ways in other minutes, and I'm sure it will be approached and broached, because these scenes, it becomes, you know, there's a great quote, and some people don't really love the movie. I'm not sure if you're a fan of it. It's talking about David Michaud's movie The Rover that stars Guy Pearce, and
I actually haven't seen it.
It's
me too. Yes.
Yeah. Look, I would definitely say it's worth watching. I'm not sure if it's it's one of the words that is often thrown about with it is elemental. It kind of strips back to real core ideas. And I think that's what, there's kind of a discomfort in just sitting with a raw nerve for a long time. And I think one of the masterful things about Heat is that it's layering us back for a long time. Like there's so much other story and thematics and ideas that are bouncing around, and they're being manifested in these interactions all throughout the movie, or huge set pieces for movement. And exactly to your point now, it's like you coalesce it down to this, the core of the idea of what it is. And it's like this undiluted thing. And if you hadn't sort of been, I don't know what it's like, it's acquiring this taste of what the undiluted idea was. By the time you get to now, it just sometimes is jarring. And I guess the Rover as a whole, like post-apocalyptic piece about survival and things like that is quite jarring in that respect, because it's just, you know, it doesn't have any artifice. It's just the ugly sort of thing, if you like. But a terrific Robert Pattinson performance, absolutely terrific. But I think in Heat right now, ideas and expressions and all that sort of stuff, it's like you're now getting permission to have, like, this is man at his most De Palma, you know, like if you talk about man as an entity, as a guy who came up and emerged as a filmmaker around the same times as your De Palmas and your Scorseses and your Coppolas, even though he sort of pivoted to television much earlier than those guys did, you know, the quintessential De Palma move is much more Hitchcockian. It's like, I'm going to tell you things visually. I don't need to say a word. I don't need to distill a character. My character's a function of the visual story I'm telling. Whereas you go to the most Scorsese, which is like all character, all people, dialogue, you know, backstory, method. It's like, we've already seen that. And now it's like, how do I strip all those bits away, strip away the Scorsese and get to the De Palma?
We're slowly reducing down again to just the two of them.
Yes.
But instead of, you know, sitting down.
From 70. There's 70 speaking characters in this movie.
But
That's a party that, you know, it's getting serious, right? When it's come from 70 people down to two, that party is getting serious.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, before the two, about this scene is it's like the visualization of a love triangle.
Yeah.
Now, bear with me.
Yeah.
Because you know, what you've got is, how did I say this to myself? The minute kind of encompasses three separate points of view. So you've got Vincent looking towards the car, and he sees the outline of a woman sitting waiting. But I'm sure that expectantly what he's hoping to see is Neil.
Mm.
And then you've got Edie watching Neil, and then you've got Neil's focus being quite split between Edie and Vincent. And yeah, it's really interesting to me, because I think the thing that struck me actually seeing it again was as Neil kind of approaches Edie in the car and he smiles at her and his attention is taken away. Like he looks towards where Vincent is, but what is it that alerts him to sort of turn his head? It's like he's got an instinctive idea that that man is coming for me, or he can sense him in the area. I don't know.
From a pure like narrative standpoint, like last time we talked, these guys are in the coffee shop. And I guess when we go back to the genesis of the story, it's Charlie Chuck Adamson, a Chicago police detective, sees Neil McCauley, a bank robber that he's been observing, you know, in the 60s in Chicago, out the front of a laundromat. He sees him. They have an opportunity right then and there to just gun each other down because he's on his tail, he's on the loose. And instead of there being this, you know, mano a mano, like gunfight, the OK Corral, like showdown back in the 60s, he's like, no, let's go grab a cup of coffee. And the big thing that Adamson sort of imprinted on man about that, and I think impressed upon him for a whole bunch of films, is like, I just wanted to get to know him. Because if I sit down in front of you and I'm looking in your eyes and we're sharing a meal together, I might just know something. And man, even in a very overt way, talks about in this moment, even in the commentary of the film, he's saying, and I try not to mention the commentary too much in One Heat Minute just for folks, is because it's not just about what Michael Mann says about the movie, it's about how we engage with it. But in his moment, the narrative crux of this exact 60-second period is Vincent sees a woman alone. And the line, I have a woman. This woman who is in a sea of people, in this flurry, in this flux, and she's just not moving. That is like when we talk about sensing that something's wrong, that is the thing that's wrong. And for him to see her, that's the reason why he goes down there. Now, I love what you said. It's like, why is De Niro noticing him? I just imagine, I've always imagined it, And this is just my impression, and totally love to tangle with you on it. It's imagine all these people walking away, being directed away, get away, get away. And then there's just something in your peripheral. It's that weird thing that tickles on the back of your neck, that something
yeah.
is running towards you. It's like you talk about the hunter and the, you know, the predator and the prey. It's like that you know, reptilian brain in the back of our heads that an animal is going to hunt us down and bite us is like that is that same feeling that is like charged up in this scene.
Well, the two of them operate on a non-intellectual level, you know.
Yes.
The way that they move through the world is very primal. It's so it totally makes sense in that respect, you know, that he would sense that he's coming for him.
Isn't that cool, though? Isn't that so romantic when you say it? It's so great.
It's so romantic.
It is. It's like I can sense that you're coming for me.
Yeah. That's the greatest romance of them all, that one.
We did mention at the top of the show, Cinna is a thirst machine, people, not just an empathy machine. I love, there might be one thing I like more than hate quotes that get, you know, chopped up and bastardized in tweets and messages between my friends and I. It might be bastardizing the great Roger Ebert quotes for modernization with thirst updates. I think that's one of my favorites too. Isn't it just a terrific performance from Amy Brenneman in this scene though, Joe? Isn't it so great?
Absolutely. Like,
seconds, and
there's so much happening on that face of hers.
Oh. Tremendously underrated in this movie, and I think in this whole little section, this little segment, from the moment that her hand starts shaking uncontrollably, where her instincts are taking over, and like she realizes innately that something is deeply wrong with everything about this entire chain of events happening, I just think from that moment, it's just like this is the thing that is on the page. I would imagine as an actor, where you're reading the descriptions and you're going, "Oh, this is the movie." Like, this is where I get to. There might be weird conflict. There might be frustrations. There might be like, does this character, can I truly surrender to this person who might be totally different from me, who's just so ready for love that they're kind of abandoning some other, you know, some of their moral guidelines, I guess you would say. Like, you know, all the things that would say to jettison someone, you're abandoning them. But like right now, this is like the money shot moment for her as a performer in this movie. It's like this great wordless scene.
She's balanced, I feel like she's balanced between hope and the resurfacing of all her doubts. You know, I think when she sees him, I think there's a moment of, okay, great, he's coming. You know, maybe he wasn't a part of whatever this mess is. And then I think there's definite, but at the same time, I'm sure she knows that, you know, he's responsible for what's going on there.
And there's a great, because he's so casual too. Like, he's jettisoning the tie, he's throwing it away, and her eyes are like, they're scanning him. Like, what? You're in different clothes.
Yeah.
You're acting so cool. Everyone else is going mental. You're just very casual as strutting out of there, happy, smiling. Something is wrong.
Yeah. And then he's forced to make, you know, we're at the beginning there of him having to decide whether he has to leave in 60 seconds flat.
In 60 seconds flat, if you spot the heat around the corner. And what's so perfect about the next minute is that it's literally butting up against his 60 seconds. And in less than 60 seconds flat, he's going to make the call. Spoilers, guys. I'm sorry that we're going to have to get into spoilers for Heat, but he's going to make the call to just make a move.
Yeah. What I do like, though, that he's allowed to have that moment of, well, I mean, we don't really have it that much in our minute here, but, I mean, it's beginning there, that there's a hesitation for him.
Oh, yeah.
It's so easy. And I think it got me thinking, too, about, you know, of the two of them, the two men, so, you know, he lives by this code, or he thinks he does. He's really probably not as disciplined anymore as he would like to think he is. And Vincent lives by his code of chasing the prey and being only the thing that he's going after. Of the two of them, the one that sticks to it better is obviously Vincent.
Mm.
But, you know, all of those codes kind of require the dismissing or leaving behind of women. And it made me think about Chris being, I mean, completely irrelevant to our minute, but
I think it's exactly relevant to our minute, by the way. Yeah, I think you're about to make, if I know what path you're going down, I think it's exactly relevant to our minute.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Chris just being, you know, he refuses to leave Charlene behind, but instead she has to release him, you know, with that sleight of her hand. You know, that's the only way that he can, for him, freedom is in having her let him go, so to speak. And
but it's know. But it's like a dead freedom. Like there's well, nothing. That's what's
they're
so
all dead, really, aren't they?
That's what's so tragic. That's what's so tragic and I think resonant about. And I think it's perfect in this moment. It's like we've watched Vincent has the easiest discipline in a way is, and I think it's in these three scenes is great comparative scenes because Justine feigns, you know, she feigns being okay or as okay with him leaving in a way to give him permission to leave. Like it's both a strengthening thing for her and a self-belief. But it's also like a sort of fatalistic view of their relationship. Like she knows he's going to go. So she kind of goes, no, I'm okay. And there's this wonderful moment where she straightens up and she repostures and then him skipping down the stairs to get out of there.
He can't run out of there fast enough.
He can't. He's given permission to be his most true self.
Yeah.
And in that moment, you do get this beautiful coda to that scene of her, like, collapse, her shoulders just fall in, and she's had to be brave in much the same way as Charlene has done to, like, cut him loose. Like, Charlene's is, I love how you put it, it is literally a sleight of hand, a beautiful little sleight of hand that says, I'm cutting you loose, you have to go, because otherwise it's imprisonment. And so that moment, huge risks, maximum risks. And it has a payoff, and the payoff for her is that she's been able to cut loose of him and shake him loose. But Chris is dead. Like his loss, he's just being discarded in that moment is so heartbreaking. And it's also heartbreaking for Justine. And now in this moment, what I think is heartbreaking for us, even in this minute before we even get to the actual in 60 seconds flat, is he going to adhere to his discipline is like, we kind of already know.
Of course, yeah.
Like we're pretty sure that if this movie is going to be true to itself, is that these guys are going to adhere to their discipline and be true to themselves, whether they like it or not. With Chris, like she's making him. She is like the Neil. She's like, no, I'm cutting you loose. The heat's around the corner. Get out of here. And so in that respect, he's kind of a dead man walking. But in this moment, you know, Edie is like there just realizing she's about to be the butt of this code.
I was thinking now too that maybe her silence, the fact that there's no speaking from her, like is almost perhaps her permission, her giving him permission to go. Like, I don't know, I'm kind of wrestling with it. Because, you know, I feel like there's an ambivalence for me. Like the romantic in me thinks, you know, this is the most heartbreaking thing that's ever going to happen to her. But then the more cynical side of me thinks that she knows that this is the only way she can move forward. And so there's no point arguing it. It's kind of like,
yeah,
if she's looking at him and there's like expression, there's like, they're both kind of reading each other with their eyes, but I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but
yeah, it's a weird,
like there's no argument really happening. No,
but I feel like there's, It's like the magnetism of two objects being like ripped apart. Like when I look at them together, I think she looks at him in disbelief. Like I've followed you into this, you know, into this chaos. Like I've been a part of this gravity and it's just like being discarded. And so when I look at her, you know, there are those pangs of, and I think I think you're so right. It's like she's a loaded weapon. Everything is just happening in how she's conveying her emotion is like, I look at that and I'm like, I can see the romance. I can also see the longing. I can see the betrayal. I can see just like being cold. I can see just like this, like a wave coming over her as well. Like he's going to leave like after everything, after the confession on the hill, he's going to be here and actually walk away from me. Like the tragedy is, and also is all of Neil's cool is gone at that point. Like even Neil at his most callous, and like my favorite callous line in this movie is like, I tell you what, I don't sell medals, you know? And that line, Like, she looks just similarly shocked and weirded out, and he's kind of still acting very cool. But here he's frazzled. Like, Vincent is here. The heat is around the corner. He's got to make his decision. Yeah, she's just a storm of emotion. It's great. It's excellent.
Yeah. I almost wish we could see what happens next to her.
Well, we might. We might. There is a Heat prequel novel. Well, everyone was thinking that it was the prequel novel. Yes, and it's written by a man by the name Reed Coleman, or Reed Farrell Coleman, depending on which of his books that you purchase. he's been given the task, he and Michael Mann are co-writing and co-producing this Heat prequel novel, but what I'm hearing is that it is both, and this is from the great Bill Gabbieri in an interview for Vulture, for another book from Michael Mann's publishing press called Hunting LaRue, is that it is both a Heat prequel and sequel.
Ooh.
So we may have a, you know, a Vincent Hanna talking to Edie scene that we never thought we'd have. I haven't yet been able to press Reed Coleman on this show about it. But you know what? What the hell? I'll just let everyone know. In, what is it? 157th minute that we're in right now. In the 162nd minute, Mr. Reed Coleman, the author of the Heat prequel and sequel novel, will be on this show. So discussing this chase, being one of those people in the next 4 minutes, as Joe was envious of, to be talking about these minutes. And maybe, you know, without spoiling things, you might tell us how much the prequel and sequel truth is on the Heat front.
Well, I look forward to hearing that.
Yeah. Well, look, you just touched on a great point, I think, that makes a lot of fans of this movie enjoy revisiting the movie, is because we ourselves are so fluid with our opinions and thoughts around people's feelings. It's really nice. This movie is like a constant, like, what the hell happens to Chris? Like, you're just one day, you're just sitting down, not doing much, and you're like, what the hell happens to Chris? Like, where the hell does he go? Like, does he start his own crew? Like, what the hell? What happened? Like, does she just go back to poor Edie? Does she just go back to Appalachia? You know, what happens? What happens to Justine? Does she marry Ralph? Like, you hope not, right? But it's like, what happens?
There's so many loose ends.
Yeah, like, you're just left with, you know, there's a kind of fallout, and there's a whole bunch of people and women particularly reeling from all of the events of this movie, and you kind of stewing in, like, there's a discomfort, but it's also like this wonderful discomfort of, like, I don't know what the hell is going to happen to all these people, but this was the time and place that we saw them all be on, you know, be all the same players on this chessboard. And you know, Chris and Charlene, I'm like, what happens to Charlene and Dominic? Like, she's a survivor, but what happens? So the police keep pressing her for a cooperation. Do they just throw her away, you know, because she couldn't deliver Chris? Like, how vindictive are they going to be? I don't think that's Vincent's crew, but, like, it's in that wheelhouse. Could there be crappy cops that, you know, press her for it? Does she stay with Marciano? No.
No way.
No way. He betrayed her. But, like, just even to get settled, I don't know. Like, it's one of those weird, things that you just, you know, you always scratch your head about.
Great films have a life that extends beyond the end credits, you know. Particularly one like this, because, I mean, its story is so enormous that even how many minutes are we talking about all up?
Well,
even
it's 166. Pre-credits.
So it can't even encompass everything in 166 minutes.
No. It's, and that's the only thing that I'm left with is wanting more. The only thing is wanting more, but kind of pleasantly.
The ending is perfect, so.
Yeah. Oh, no, you want more from the different characters. I feel like there's nothing about, that's a great point. There's nothing that is imperfect about the ending. The ending is overwhelming. The ending's overwhelming is my only word for it. It's just overwhelming. It gets me every single time. And as we approach it and we're within 9 minutes of it. So I'm really looking forward to
it. You can practically smell it.
I can feel the energy like Vincent. Like my hands, I'm like, I can feel it. It's there. It's this big thing that's just around the corner. Just around the corner. It's overwhelming. It's overwhelming to think about. That's one of those great and terrifying things of Twitter. Is there's a great account, I know, I'm pretty sure you follow it too, Joe, is One Perfect Shot. And they do those wonderful, all those, you know, beautiful little GIFs now, which is wonderful as well, of just those absolutely little slivers of cinematic perfection throughout the years. And I think intermittently people just re-tag me on the One Perfect Shot that is the final image from Heat, that like, you know, that like industrial neon vista, like that it is of like these guys there. I just am like, oh God, there it is. There it is. There's that final shot of this movie that we've spent now nearly 150 hours talking about.
That is perfect.
That is perfect and intimidatingly perfect.
I just wanted to go back to something you said, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but just the other thing that's really interesting about this very short scene is the way, for me, it kind of also visualizes what Justine says about everything else being the mess that's left behind.
Oh yeah,
because you kind of just got you've got the mess made, kind of it's happening there on the screen, and eventually, you know, he's going to run through it. I mean, we get to that point as he's sort of approaching it, and yeah, I mean, it's just. To go back to what I was saying about the, you know, the men kind of having to leave the women, but you know, there is a cost to all of that. That's actually, I feel like is, you know, it's enormous, and it's, you know, it's part of that thing that we don't get to see, the price that all of these women really are paying for loving these men who just actually do physically move away from them and out of the scene and out of their lives. And but you do get to see it here. You know, you get to see it with Amy's character standing there, Edie standing there, and the mess is about to, like, literally, well, she is the mess.
she's left as the mess.
Yeah.
I think what's good about this movie, and obviously there's, you know, we can talk about how it's not touched on, but it's like, actually getting to frame that there is mess is a nice reprieve, because so many of these movies, you're like, there's a random guy who's their driver or whatever gets shot, and it's just, who cares? Like, there's no emotional weight. He's not a connected being in the universe. It's like, he's just this floating entity.
In this one.
Yeah. You know? And so when you see Don Breeden go down, your insides are screaming, because you know that there's going to be a Lillian shot. Like, we've already had it framed at the beginning of the heist that, you know, Charlene's making Dominic breakfast and Elaine's making, you know, Michael Torito's girls, you know, getting them ready for school or whatever the case may be. Like, there's things happening. Edie's packing shelves at a crappy day job, right? Like, or a pretty good day job, because she gets discounts, as she tells us. But yeah, you get these senses, but. And that's the emotional, heart-wrenching scene here, is because you're literally seeing it. There's no distance between it unfolding. Like, from this moment, we watch her tussle. We watch that tussle between them, those emotions, that electrical charge. And then he walks away, essentially. And we just have to – we do get the moment where you're, like, staring at her literally being the mess that is left behind by Neil, and Vincent just streaming past her, like just running straight past her.
Yeah. I mean, look, it is, I really do feel that for me, the reason this film is an important film for me, and I think a resonant film and a film that I never really tire of watching, is because it does give importance to the female characters. I mean, I don't feel like they're really secondary. There's always going to be secondary characters in, as you said, there's, what, 70 characters?
70 speaking roles in this movie. It is nuts. Roles.
Like, you know, somebody's got to come second and third and fourth and 69. But I never feel like
70 is Bud Cort, for the record.
Of course. Yeah, I think you'd probably be right there. You know, everything, you get a very strong sense of who all these women are, and I think as a result you care about what's going to happen to them, you know, and that's, I just think it makes it the film that it is. Yeah. On top of all the other great things about it, but.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, I've increasingly, and you know, one of the deeper, much deeper appreciations that I have now is every relationship. I just love every relationship, because if you like a character in this movie, you know, if you, you know, from your my first watches as like a teenage kid who had no concept really what the hell was going on except for the kiss, kiss, bang, bang, or just mostly the bang, bang, crash, crash, explosion, you know, great ass. Like, that's basically all those things. All my epic moments as a teenager. And to now, when you watch it, it's like, you love Chris because of Charlene. Like, Charlene and Chris, their relationship is inseparable to the narrative. Like, it's not like I have a relationship with Chris as this thing. It's like Chris is the guy with this young family, and Vincent's this guy in the, you know, in the third marriage, and Neil's this guy who, you know, is having his first relationship. You know, his first girlfriend. I think one of the great guests of this show puts it as like, he's his first girlfriend. Like, he's new at this. Like, he, you know, he's so inexperienced, and he's been so
much, really.
Yeah, he's in so institutionalized for so long, like, in a incarceration, that like he's like such an emotional novice, and she's so lonely, and is seeking and searching for connection, that like they just grab onto each other, and this moment, like, wordlessly, like, their fate is being sealed. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think that's a perfect way to end this episode. I just want to say a massive thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
A massive thank you to you, Joe, for being a part of the show. Thank you so much for being a part of the epic diner conversation. I wouldn't have it any other way. And thank you so much for being back for this minute, this epic, gorgeous minute that it is.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Special mention, though, to Al Pacino's hair, which at the beginning of this sequence and right to the end of the film, I think barely moves and looks wonderfully blow waved from start to finish. Oh,
we haven't talked about the blow wave enough, but I think his hair is looking phenomenal in every frame.
It gets higher and higher. So, you know, I wish I could run and look that good, but anyway.
Well, look. I only wish that, listen to the show, if any of you are brave enough to listen to the show and run on a treadmill while you're listening, or go for a run around the block, I hope you, Joanna and I both wish you the blow wave of Vincent Hanna. You have to, I'm just going to say for a brief moment, you have to follow Joe on Twitter at Joanna DiMattia, which is DiMattia, and her website, which does link off to all of her other bits and pieces that are around all those other publications that I mentioned, inalonelyplacefilm.com. Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Blake. Good luck with the rest of it. Have fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Garth Franklin, for our web design, Mr. Paul Davies for our theme, and we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute. Not many left, just around the corner. And may your blow waves be high and consistent. Thank you.